Good morning, everyone. I'd like to convene the February 5th, 2015 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Good morning to everyone. Thank you for your patience as we've waited for traffic problems north of here. I suspect that at least one of our members is caught up in that traffic jam. So, Representative Gorsuch, I hope will be able to join us here shortly. Also noted for the record, Representative Krieger is in district on district business and excused here today. So with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2452. And Mr. Gallagher, if you could just give us a very brief synopsis of what this bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the measure would abolish Fish and Wildlife deferred maintenance subaccount and transfer any unobligated monies remaining in that subaccount to the State Wildlife Fund.
Very good. Thank you. And I would like to ask Kurt Melcher, please, to come forward and tell us a little bit about background on that bill. I suspect you may have someone else, Brett, welcome, who'd like to join you. And please feel free to invite anyone else that you'd like to join you here this morning. Thank welcome, you. And we're glad to have you this morning. Thank you for being here, and look forward to the background on this bill.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, interim director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I do, I guess I'll start with two short apologies. First, I noticed that my testimony is dated February 2nd as opposed to February 5th, so even though I know it's not Groundhog's Day, but we had our testimony dated on Groundhog's Day. So my apologies for that.
So noted.
For that. And then I do have a Ways and Means Natural Resource Subcommittee hearing at 8:30, so I'll be stepping out of the room.
All right.
At 8:30. Brett Brownscombe is here. Mr. Brownscombe is serving as my interim deputy director for the next, well, through the session at least. He's come to us on loan from the governor's office. We're very pleased to have him. He has a great deal of experience with our policy issues. He'll be in the building here working with you all really on a daily basis on legislative issues, and then you'll see me occasionally as well.
Well, welcome to you both.
Very good. So I want to start then this morning talking with you about House Bill 2452. I appreciate the opportunity to present this to you today. Essentially, this bill would abolish our deferred maintenance subaccount. The deferred maintenance subaccount is a subaccount within our general wildlife account. The Fish and Wildlife deferred maintenance subaccount was developed initially in 2001. It was funded with a combination of state general fund and fishing and hunting license dollars. The intent on that fund was that the principal would stand, and the interest that accrued on that principal would be utilized to fund maintenance at our facilities around the state, ongoing maintenance. Since, I believe in 2009, that the principal in that account was reduced by 62%. The state general fund component was removed from the fund. So the fund now has basically a principal of the original $1.5 million of fishing and hunting license dollars sitting in the fund. At the same time, over the last 5 or 6 years, we've, of course, seen historically low interest rates. And the interest that's accruing on this account is very, very small, small enough that it's really not addressing our deferred maintenance needs. At the same time, as we developed our budget for the next, well, for the 15-17 biennium, but as we planned it out for the next 6 years, we have a need for cash flow, basically just for covering what we refer to as float. We do a lot of contract work that's funded through federal agencies and others. We float those. We do that work, make the payroll, pay for supplies and services, and then we get reimbursed after the fact by outside entities, the federal government in particular. So we always try to maintain a balance in our account of course, so that we make payroll, so that we can pay our bills. And as we developed our budget over the coming 6 years, we have a slight shortage in our preferred or our strategic ending balance needs. That shortfall was $1.5 million. And as we developed our budget package, which is a combination, and I know we're not going to go into it all here today, but it was a combination of program reductions, fee increases, as well as restoration of general fund for program activities. We, with that $1.5 million shortfall in our cash flow ending balance, we elected to propose that we shift our deferred maintenance account into our Fish and Wildlife account, really for operating capital. We discussed this all through our public process with our external budget advisory committee, with LFO as we developed our budget, as well as with the public and our commission and the governor's office, and had strong support for that. I did want to mention also that we're not, of course, abandoning our work on maintenance activities or deferred maintenance. We continue to do that work. However, this sub-account is really not, it's basically meaningless as it relates to our deferred maintenance needs. So we've been addressing those through a variety of other fund sources. So for federally funded fish hatcheries, we're, of course, using federal funds dedicated to those facilities to address maintenance. We, at our state wildlife areas and state wildlife offices, we're using federal funds, Pittman-Robertson funds, which come to us in the form, well, they come to us basically as a result of excise taxes on arms and ammunition. Those federal revenues have increased dramatically over the last 6 years and continue to come at a very high rate compared to historic levels. So we've been addressing deferred maintenance with through the use of Pittman-Robertson funds. And then we've also been addressing deferred maintenance at our state fish hatcheries through our restoration and enhancement grant program. I would also add that it's not in the testimony or in the written testimony, but at all of our facilities, our fish hatcheries, both state and federal, our employees, many of them, most of them, in fact, live on station in state-owned housing. They pay rent to the state for those for that housing, and we essentially keep that rent money to do maintenance activities on the facility and on the housing. So with that, I guess I would just conclude by saying that for us, this really comes down to a risk management issue. We're trying to reach our minimum threshold for cash flow and efficiently manage the agency's budget. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. This is part of our bigger budget package, so you'll see this bill has a referral to Ways and Means. It will then be folded into our larger budget discussion.
Thank you very much. Before we take general questions, Kurt, you mentioned in your testimony that there's been a significant uptick in the PR funds, the Pittman-Robertson. Could you tell us why the large increase?
Sure, Chair Witt, members of the committee. So the Pittman-Robertson funds come to us. I believe the program was created in 1937, if I remember correctly. It's a federal excise tax on all arms and ammunition. So the consumer doesn't see the tax. It's paid basically at the manufacturer or distributor level. That federal tax, in the federal law, it's required that those funds be distributed back to the state fish and wildlife agencies to do wildlife management activities. And the distribution back to the state comes in the form of a match. So it's a complicated formula based on land mass, but also one of the critical factors is the number of hunting licenses that are sold. So for every paid hunting license that we sell in the state, we get approximately, it varies, it's been increasing, but $7 to $10 of federal match that comes back to the Fish and Wildlife Agency for work on wildlife management activities. Over the last 6 years, as you've probably seen in the media and elsewhere, there's been quite an expansion of the purchase of arms and ammunition. A dramatic expansion. I think our Pittman-Robertson revenues have almost doubled from where they were in the late 90s, for instance. And so we're using those funds to do a number of activities, not just deferred maintenance, but expanding our ability to do deer census, habitat improvement work, broad spectrum of activities.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, general questions. Representative Whitsitt, please.
So, basically, you would be using this as a one-time addition to Fish and Wildlife, a general fund, if you will, to balance your budget at the year's end.
Sure, Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt. So, the transfer would go into our basically our wildlife account, which is our big operating account where all of our licensed dollars go. And we have no policy package to spend the $1.5 million. It's really just to be there for operating capital for cash flow purposes.
Okay, so I just want to follow
Please.
Up. So what would happen, how do you anticipate equaling that amount in the next biennium since it's a one-time thing this time?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, that's an excellent question. And since we're using it simply for cash flow purposes, it doesn't go away. So it sits there and carries forward. So it is truly, we have a one-time need, and it's truly a one-time transfer. Those dollars would sit in that account.
Additional questions, Representative McEwen.
Chair Witt, thank you. Director Melcher, I'm reading your comments in the material, the bill analysis that you provided, and it does indicate that the organizations that support hatcheries may be disappointed because there may be some effect on the ability of the department to continue to maintain them at the level desired. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? Because this obviously is an issue that's very important for
Sure.
those of us on the coast.
And before you proceed, is the audience able to hear all of us? Because I'm having a hard time. I just had a hard time hearing Representative McEwen. I don't know if it's me or whether we're picking up adequately here. Can the audience hear us? Okay. It may be me. So I'm sorry, Representative.
Would you like me to repeat that?
No, that's fine.
Sure, Chair Witt, Representative
yeah,
McEwen.
Thank you.
For us, it's really a perceived issue. In that the deferred maintenance sub-account is generating so little interest that it is not addressing our deferred maintenance needs. So while there may be some folks who think we're abandoning our deferred maintenance responsibilities, the reality is the account and its current financial structure is not providing those needs as it currently sits.
Follow-up.
Please.
So what I'm hearing you say is nothing's really changing with the passage of this bill and moving those funds into another account.
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, that's correct. We'll continue to address deferred maintenance needs with the, as I laid out earlier, with a combination of federal funds at our federal fish hatcheries, restoration enhancement grant funds at our state hatcheries, and then federal funds, Pittman-Robertson funds at our wildlife areas and wildlife offices.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, and Representative, thank you very much. I think that is a critically important point to be made and for the public to understand. So, Vice Chair McLean, did you have
I guess you piqued my interest because I didn't bring down another sheet of paper that I had that was talking about your budget. But what is the state grant program, I mean, as far as, you know, a trend? Is that grant program that you're using for some of those state areas, is it going up? Is it stable or is it going down?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative McLean, it's basically stable.
Okay.
So when we look over the last decade of our, it comes to us basically in the form of a surcharge on fishing licenses. It's the restoration enhancement surcharge. When we look at the sale of licenses and the revenues to that account over the last decade, they're basically stable.
Okay.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Melcher, on Pittman-Roberts, how much do we receive a year or this last year from that sale of ammunition?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I believe...
Well, it's more than ammunition, but...
Yeah, it's sporting arms and ammunition, both. Last year, which it comes on the federal fiscal year, but... we received, I believe, it was in excess of $13 million. So when you put that on a biennial basis, it's well over $20 million per biennium. Historically, I think if you go back a decade before this latest boom, if you will, in arms and ammunition sales, it was about half that.
I suspect, too, that increases in the price of ammunition in the last recent number of years may have had some kind of impact on that as well.
Sure, Chair Witt. It is an excise tax. I want to say it's about 7% at the wholesale level. So it's a combination both of increases in the volume of sales, but also the increase in the value or the cost of those items.
Very good. Additional questions or comments? Yes, Representative Barreto, please.
Chair Witt. Thank you. You had mentioned that the Robertson Pittman is tied to license sales. Is that correct? And then in your commentary, you also mentioned raising prices or fees on license. Do you see that as you raising license fees, dropping the sale of licenses to where it gets beyond where some people can afford, and then that affecting the income from the Robertson Pittman Fund, and then also that being kind of a volatile number based on ammunition and arms sales, which there has been a trend up, but now you see a little bit of a trend down in that too.
Yeah. Chair Witt, Representative Barreto. So we certainly recognize that there's important price points as it relates to our licenses. These license products, these activities are all, as it relates to recreational fishing and hunting, they're all discretionary activities. They're not compelled to go fishing or to go hunting. They can choose other things. They can choose to go golfing or, pick the recreational activity. So we're very sensitive to having increases in license costs that negatively impact our sales. We've been basically as on the fishing side over the last decade, we've basically been flat. So our hunting license sales have been stable. Our fee proposal that we have this session really structure it. It's a new way in terms of we are structuring our increases incrementally over time, as opposed to in the past we've had essentially one increase that was designed to last us for 6 years. We've changed that. We heard from our customers that they preferred smaller incremental increases over time as opposed to one large jump. So we have done that, and that is part of our fee bill. But we're very sensitive to that issue as well, and we do not want to price individuals out of the market. We think, I think I've had this conversation with Representative Witt and others, but we could probably charge 10 times what we charge now for our licenses and cut the number of tags by 90%, and the budget would balance. Because there's a segment of society that would pay that much, and it would balance our budget. But we don't think that's a good model as it relates to the future of hunting. And certainly, our model is one of having an affordable activity for everyone. Our fee bill does also include reductions in cost for juvenile participation as well.
Thank you.
And Representative Barreto, there is a work group that was formed as a result of this committee's work. Last session, the two gentlemen before us are part of that work group. Several of us on this committee are. You would be welcome to join us. I know there are a number of people that are in the audience that are also part of that, and this is only one component, the subject that you've just been addressing that we've been working on, yeah, among others. And so anyways, if that's something that's of interest to you, you might want to consider joining us. So with that, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the last time we raised the tags and fees and licenses, I believe it was 6 or 8 years ago, pretty close, something like that. What was the percentage of increase at that time?
Representative Witt, or Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I'd have to go back and dig into it, but it was fairly sizable. I think it was about a 40% increase in fees, and that was enough to last us for 6 years, which it has done.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony, and also appreciate your commitment to continuing with hatchery maintenance. So thank you very much.
Chair Witt, I am going to go down the hall here, but Brett.
Understood.
Mr. Roundstone will be staying.
Very good. Thank you very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify this morning on House Bill 2452? I'm not seeing anyone. As a result, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2452, and I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2452. Committee members, you've heard the testimony. I am not aware of any other groups out there.
You're ringing. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I neglected to turn my phone off.
Okay.
I'm
That's
very
quite
sorry.
All right. I was about to suggest that maybe we were having a drill, but I guess
fire
not.
Drill. Fire drill hit the street.
My most humble apologies. I will not let that happen again.
Quite all right.
I better look at
committee members, I am not aware of any group that's come forward that has any opposition or even significant heartburn on this. I don't know if any of you have been approached by anyone, but I would like to be able to move this bill forward if there's if there seems to be general agreement on that. And with that said, opportunity for anybody to voice a concern at this point. I'm going to recognize Vice Chair McLean.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2452 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and also make sure that the bill will be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean has moved House Bill 2452 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on her motion? I am seeing none. With that, is there any objection to her motion? Seeing none, hearing none. The motion passes. Thank you very much, Vice Chair and committee members. Greatly appreciated. We are moving our agenda, and I thank you for that good work. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2452 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2453. Thank you very much. Chuck, can you tell us about this one, please?
Chairman Witt, members of the committee, this measure requires organizers of large commercial events on state forest lands to obtain permits from the Oregon Department of Forestry. It also authorizes ODF to adopt rules establishing health and safety standards for such events, consider environmental and resource impacts, charge permit fees, covering the cost of permit review, and authorizes ODF to refuse, suspend, or revocate a permit under certain circumstances, and it also establishes penalties and fines.
Very good. Thank you. And I understand that we've received a just-in-time fiscal impact.
Yeah. We have received a just-in-time fiscal impact.
Thank you. And I have not had a chance to read it, and I don't know whether you have or not, but do we have...
Minimal expenditure.
It is a minimal expenditure impact in very bold print, so they must mean what they're saying. So with that, I am... I'm going to call forward, please, Liz Dent. And I think
Paul Bell.
And Paul Bell. And if there is anyone else that you would like to have join you, please feel free to call them forward as well. Good morning, and welcome to our committee. Your first appearance, both of you, this session. Good to see you, and look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Witt.
I'm Paul Bell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Forestry, and with me today is Liz Dinn, our State Forest Division Chief. State Forester Decker asked me to convey his apologies for not being able to be here to attend today, as he's actually returning from his visit with Boys of London as we speak.
It was a tough fire season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would offer up talking to Doug lately. Yesterday, sounds like conversations over there have been going very well.
So. I'm pleased. We would, our state would be in a world of hurt. Absent that insurance policy,
yep.
A world of hurt. So that's good news. Thank you.
So we are here today to provide testimony on House Bill 2453 relating to commercial events on state forests and to answer any questions you may have. So with that, I'll turn it over to Liz, and she'll walk through our testimony.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning, Chair Witt. And for the record, my name is Liz Dent. As Paul said, I'm the Division Chief for State Forests. So as was summarized for you this morning, this bill addresses large commercial, unpermitted social events that occur on state forests. These events are commonly referred to as raves. These events draw a large number of people, as much as 400 to 800 people, which is obviously quite a bit for our forest to accommodate. With that type of attendance, there can be hundreds of vehicles as well. So there are several implications for these types of events on state forests. Law enforcement authorities tell us and report several problems, including illegal drug use, a high likelihood of sexual assault, sanitation problems, unsafe, intoxicated driving, irresponsible fires that obviously can present fire danger problems, garbage dumping, and with all of this, a fair amount of damage to our road and forest resources. So clearly these events not only present damage to our state forests, but they also present a risk to surrounding forest landowners. So sheriffs have reported several events occurring each year, ranging between 5 to 19 in recent years. So another issue with these events is that they typically occur far away from the resources that the sheriffs have to respond to the problems. Clatsop and Tillamook County sheriffs have further reported the personal safety challenges that they face when they approach these events and attempt to control them or shut them down. So here they are, you know, one or two people approaching. They're clearly outnumbered when approaching these types of events. There's some other factors to consider here. The organizers of these events collect as much as $10,000 to $40,000 per event, so that's a fair amount of revenue. Under current authority, these are considered simply a violation that comes with a penalty of $500. So clearly that is a minimal restriction or outcome for these organizers and really is considered simply a minor inconvenience. So adoption of this bill would do several things. First of all, it would establish the ability of ODF to require permits. Under these permits, there would be a requirement that these commercial events would be defined as a rave if they exceed 20 participants or 15 or more vehicles, and if they last more than 3 hours. This bill is important because it empowers law enforcement to make arrests, and because it shifts the enforcement from a violation to a Class A misdemeanor. What happens because of the shift to a Class A misdemeanor is there's a fairly significant increase in the fiscal penalties associated with these events, or prison time, Or a court could rule that the offenders have to pay twice the amount of the fiscal gain that they are getting from the event. So this is a meaningful increase in penalties over the current $500 violation. Under this misdemeanor classification, law enforcement officers could also seize the light and sound equipment that the organizers have, which clearly reduces the attraction of the event and may stop the event that is occurring and/or reduce the potential for these events to occur in the future because they wouldn't have the equipment that they need to host the event. So several benefits of moving this from a violation to a Class A misdemeanor. The other benefit of permitting these events is that it would alert authorities as to where and when the events are occurring, which allows them to plan accordingly and perhaps monitor the events. The adoption of this bill will provide a disincentive to organizers, ideally, to simply to put on these raves, and it would potentially reduce the frequency of the raves and the unsafe and unsanitary conditions that are associated with the events on state forests. So with that, I think it's important to recognize that this bill has support from our county sheriffs. Particularly, we've got written testimony presented to you by Tillamook and Clatsop County Sheriff Departments. And because of the several issues that have been presented in terms of sanitary and safety concerns, it is clearly important to make this change from the current violation that has the minimal fine of $500 or the maximum fine of $500 to a misdemeanor, Class A misdemeanor, and the associated increase in penalties associated with that. And so with that, I am done with my testimony and turn it over to the subcommittee to answer questions.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, if we could, in relationship as to look forward and consider the work session, it has come to our attention very late in the game, late afternoon yesterday, that we may have not have the procedure precisely in place with the Department of Land Use Conservation in relationship to permitting processes. And so we, regardless where you go today, we would ask to be able to come back before the work session and ensure we have that correct.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate I appreciate that. We want to make sure we get this right the first time. I have to tell you, I consider it an outrage that this kind of activity happens on our state's public lands, taxpayer-supported public lands, it just sounds like, it's a rave. And I, Liz, the kind of illegal activities that you referenced cannot be tolerated. And the fact that people's personal safety would be jeopardized by these kinds of activities, we have to find a way of managing it. We have to put a stop to that. I personally find it hard to believe that these kinds of activities go on, but I guess I'm somewhat naive. So with that, committee members, Representative Whitsitt, please.
In the bill, it doesn't explicitly say raves or musical events. So what would the way the bill is written, it doesn't explicitly require that the events not interfere with forest practices being conducted on these lands. So could a group obtain a permit and then use it as a license to obstruct a forest practice? Say you have a group that they are opposed to logging and they get a permit and go in and then sit in trees or you know, spike trees or whatever?
That's a good question, Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt. That is not the direction of the bill. This is specifically directed to these specific events and the problems associated with them, and really empowering law enforcement to respond and plan for them.
Follow up.
Please.
But it doesn't say that in the bill. So I'm asking you, can you add something that says that's what it's directed at? The way that it's written, as I read it, anybody could apply for a permit and then do what they want to do on the land. And I don't see anything about music or what you're talking about in this bill. So, I mean, you need to look the other way. You don't want to close the land off for the public, but you also don't want to allow for something that will interfere with logging that then you have sanctioned, essentially, that's already, you know, approved forest practice use. Yeah. So.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, that's an excellent point, and I think we can improve on the bill language to help address that. You know, specifically, and I don't know if this addresses your concern, but it does clarify that this is intended to address the large gatherings, so that may or may not exclude the concern that you have about people that are protesting forest management.
And thank you. And Representative Whitsitt, I wanted to drill down on this a little bit, because as testimony was occurring, something occurred to me. I'd gone through the bill and at some length, and while Liz was addressing us, I began to wonder. So the authority to issue a permit, can I assume that there's also the authority to withdraw that permit if we get into a rave and we decide this isn't such a good experience after all and we need to shut it down?
Chair Witt, that's a great question, and that's exactly what this bill allows us to do.
Okay. All right. I want to make that clear for the record, that ability rests with the department, and we don't have to go through some kind of long, litigious process. I mean, at the point that people's personal safety is, we've crossed the line and we've jeopardized the public safety, you can make that determination, and without having to go to court and without, you know, a long, drawn-out legal process, you can observe the illegal activity and determine at that point this is no longer worthy of a State of Oregon Department of Forestry permit. We are revoking that permit on the spot.
That's correct.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure that record was very clear. I think most of the committee here has questions at this point, and I don't remember who came first, so I'm just going to go right down the line here with Vice Chair McLean.
Oh, well, thank you. My understanding is that, I mean, you have to have what I would call a certain types of state lands where you allow logging and you have a particular permit for that as well, and that you would not be giving permits in areas where you already have a permit for logging. I really believe that some of those questions that were just asked are so important, but it seems to me that you must have a process in place, because we have a land use system, and you as a department have those types of categories. So could you just explain that a little bit more to the committee?
Yeah, Chair Witt and Representative McLean, I think that's an important point that we'd like to clarify on. Yeah, first of all, this is directed at state forests, so your statement is accurate. We do manage our timber sale process through a contract process that brings with it a whole range of expectations associated with that. And so the intention, or the direction, again, of this bill is to allow us to really understand where these are occurring and what we can do to control them. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think it does. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, as a department, you know where you don't want these to happen. And I think you've got a system in place or categories of land in place where you can say, no, we can't give you a permit for that because we've got an active logging operation going on. We have a contract with this logging group.
Right.
And it seems to me like you've got that in place. So it doesn't have to maybe necessarily be in the bill. Maybe you need to reference it.
Did you want to address that?
I think it needs to be in
the bill. Chair Witt, Representative McLean, you're right, it doesn't explicitly represent that concern. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things we're trying to be sensitive about and make sure that we address is the right that people have to, you know, to express their, to protest and express their concerns. So that is a fine line that we have to walk and make sure that we're not limiting that right. But with this permitting process, we would be able to understand where it is that they want to set up their rave, and allow us to work with the organizer to, you know, make sure that it's in a place that's compatible with forest use.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
And Liz, I'm gonna make the request that you go back and. Maybe provide that assurance, so maybe it is a reference in the bill, but if you could perhaps work with, if any of the committee members have a particular interest, and I know a couple of you have come to me already with this specific concern, if you would share those with Liz, and we can make sure that we provide you that level of comfort, I think, which would help us to all feel good. It may well be there now, but that extra level of comfort may be very important, so, and helpful to our committee. So thank you. Representative Esquivel, next.
I'm good.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative McLean.
I could have just been.
Thank you, Chair Witt. And Representative Witsit raised an issue in my mind that may or may not be related, and if you could clarify it for me, it would be helpful. You're referencing a large commercial event over a certain period of time with a certain number of people, whether it's the Elliott or the Tillamook Forest. If somebody wanted to hold a wedding where you brought in a commercial catering service, it would fall under the guise of large event with a large commercial event, or if you wanted to do a memorial service, which happens at times where you gather a large group of people for a social event, how would that be defined or not defined in the language that's in the bill at this time?
Representative, you could save that for the future generation and tell the kids when they're old enough that I get married at a rave.
Chair Witt,
a memorial
Representative McKeown,
yeah.
Thank you very much for the question. I think that's an excellent clarification. So currently we are under statute and OAR, we have the ability to permit commercial events. And there's a number of scenarios in which we do that. And so the point being, if the activity that, you know, the ideas that you've referenced are occurring, and can be established that they're commercial events, then we would have the ability, we would permit that, mm-hmm. and know where the what's taking place and where it's occurring, and move on. So we do have the ability to work with, you know, church groups and other organizations that want to use the forest to, you know, either personal enjoyment or to promote a product under Under Armour, for example, has had has filmed there for commercials. We've had Jeeps come together to promote the Jeeps. So there are plenty of examples where this is currently occurring on the forest.
Thank you so much. Follow up,
please.
I could see a Sportsman's Caucus event being something that could have a commercial component to it at some point in time.
Well, we want to make sure we have elk tags.
That's right. Thank you for the clarification. I just wanted to make sure things weren't getting tied up that shouldn't be tied up. I appreciate it.
Very good. Additional questions or comments?
Chair Witt?
Please, Representative Barreto.
Just following up on that, if there's already this mechanism in place to allow functions like that, then it seems like just an amendment to that would be appropriate, you know, to prevent things like the raves.
Right. So, Chair Witt and Representative Barreto, I think that I really appreciate you bringing that up, because one of the key elements of this bill is moving these types of violations from simply a violation with a $500 fine to a Class A misdemeanor, which again brings several benefits to law enforcement, to allow them to make arrests, and of course the penalties are much higher. And in this way, the real desire here is to present a disincentive to organizers and participants to really use the forest, which we think is incompatible, to use the forest in this way.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Yes, Paul.
If I could follow up on that, Representative Chair Witt, that too in itself is a little bit dealing with the procedural process we have with DLCD in relationship to having permitting authority, but having that permitting authority match up with the state land use laws in relationship to large gatherings. So that's the one piece we're hanging out here.
Yeah. Okay, very, very good. Are there any final questions or comments for our panel? I'm not seeing any. I would appreciate your working with the any other departments, Paul, as you mentioned, and Liz, adding that level of comfort here for our committee. And I am going to hold off on any work session while you accomplish that. And out of courtesy to Representative Krieger, whose bill and who has a keen interest in the bill, we're going to wait to work this, and we'll look forward to having your amendments back, and we'll try and get this bill up and out of here as soon as possible. So thank you very, very much. This is a critically important bill. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Chairman.
Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify this morning on House Bill 2453? I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2453. Pardon me, folks, here while I shuffle papers just for a second. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2537. Chuck, what's this one about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the measure increases damages for unlawful taking or killing of wildlife. It creates a rebuttable presumption of intent to sell, barter, trade, import, export wildlife parts, and establishes penalties. It also imposes additional mandatory fines for certain convictions, and it adds additional animals and animal parts to the list of parts that are unlawful to be removed from wildlife.
Thank you very, very much. And while we have, when our two witnesses are finished with their testimony, if we have a witness sheet, I don't need it just this second, but like to welcome Representative Helm and Attorney Dave Krakke. We are exceedingly fortunate in the amount of free legal help that we have received on this bill, and two very competent legal folks who are before us here today. And I want to note for the record that Representative Helm is a chief co-sponsor of this bill, and if it doesn't appear on your bill here, it will be there before this bill ends up on our House floor, hopefully. And I want to thank Mr. Krakke for all of the hard work that he has done, and there will be, I think, a number of other witnesses who have played some very crucial roles in this bill as well. But this is an opportunity for us to be able to crack down on some just horrendously objectionable activities with the result of significant damage to our wildlife populations. I thank you both for bringing this bill forward, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair McClain, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here before you. And I would like to extend thanks to our chair. We brought this idea to Chair Witt before the session began, and with his guidance and support, we were able to craft a legislative concept that has turned into the bill before you. So thank you, Chair Witt, for your help on that. Members of the committee, this legislation comes to you in one of the great traditions of our state, and that is a good idea from a citizen participant. This is David's idea, and he mentioned it to me back when I met David during the primary election. And at that time...
Excuse me, Representative, would you introduce yourself, for the record? Thank you very much.
Representative Ken Helm, District 34.
Thank you very much, and welcome.
As I was saying, I met Dave Craggy during the primary campaign, and he mentioned at that time a problem that he had just learned about of the illegal trade in poached black bear gallbladders that were being sold into the Asian medicine market, and it was shocking to me, and he's going to explain the details of that more. After the general election was complete, we put our heads together and drafted the language that's before you now. As we did more research on this topic, it became clear that beyond just the poaching of bears, poaching of our fish and game species in this state is an epidemic right now. And evidence of that epidemic can be seen if you simply go to the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Section's webpage, and you'll see the top two stories right now are on successful capture operations of poachers who are poaching deer on our public lands. There are three important parts of this bill, three things generally that it does. First, it significantly increases the penalties for knowingly and illegally taking fish and game species. Penalties that are high enough to act as deterrents rather than just a cost of doing business. Secondly, it targets the trafficking in illegally obtained animal body parts by both increasing the monetary and criminal penalties. And third, it revives important provisions of the existing statute that regard the sentencing of criminal poachers, and those provisions automatically sunsetted earlier this year in January. And this bill revives that language and does the same job that two other bills that have been introduced, one by Representative Krieger, HB 2052, and Senate Bill 175, sponsored by Senator Boquist. Both of those bills want to revive the same language, and it's my belief that our bill is in lockstep with their bill, so I don't see any conflict. If we discover that there are minor differences as we move along, we'll make them compatible. Right now, I don't think they're incompatible in any way. So as an avid steelhead fisherman myself, and an outdoor enthusiast, I'm coming at this problem from a couple of different perspectives. First, as a sportsman, I'm fiercely protective of our historic fishing and hunting heritage in this state. And secondly, throughout the state, our fishing and hunting outfitters and businesses are a huge economic benefit for employment and revenue. And we cannot allow poachers to degrade those markets. So there's two different perspectives I'm coming at here. And that's why I think that this bill is critically important. That's the end of my presentation, with the exception of noting that I think with your materials today, you have a memo from my office that identifies, is that correct? Okay, it did make it, very good. That identifies a handful of friendly amendments to the bill. Those amendments come to you has recommendations from individuals and groups that previewed the legislative concept and gave us feedback. They're for your consideration, and I generally think that they will improve the bill. I also had the opportunity just yesterday afternoon to go over the bill a little more detail with Captain Jeff Samuels of the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. He mentioned a couple of other things that I'd like to follow up in the near future that clarify our bill and the operation of the statute. So we may need to have further amendments as well.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Chair Witt, Vice Chair McClain, members of the committee. My name is David Cracky. I'm a member of the international board of an organization called Wild Aid. Wild Aid's whole purpose is to reduce the demand for endangered species parts and other animal parts, particularly in China, in Vietnam, and in other Asian countries. We've been very successful in our efforts, but unfortunately, the demand for those animal parts still exists and is still rampant. Oregon's wildlife, as Representative Helm just mentioned, is being poached at an alarming rate. This includes bear, cougar, sturgeon, salmon, elk, deer, other species. And this poaching is occurring, in my opinion at least, without regard for legal consequences because the teeth just aren't there currently. As a result, it shows the need to increase the consequences. In 2011, this committee and this body passed what is now known as the shark fin ban. Chair Witt was instrumental in the passage of that bill, and it basically showed the international community and as well as the citizens of Oregon that Oregon was going to take this matter very seriously. That essentially was followed relatively immediately by a passage of shark fin soup, the possession, sale, and trade of shark fin down in California. And then amazingly, we had repercussions in China where the Central Committee then banned shark fin soup from all official state functions. It was a great victory. Shows that our educational efforts here are working to influence practices where it really matters. That being said, we must now recognize that there is a significant threat to Oregon's wildlife, that the cougars, the bears, the sturgeon are being used and are helping to fuel international trade in parts from those animals. While we were celebrating the shark fin ban in 2011-2012 and working for further effort, the police sting operation up in Walla Walla, Washington occurred where a man was arrested while attempting to buy 40 bear gallbladders. I envision these bear gallbladders in a big Ziploc bag of some sort, each gallbladder obviously representing a poached bear. In addition, he was going to buy a cougar carcass. Sex organs were going to be used and exported, as were the bones. Unfortunately, because tigers are so imperiled, lions, cougars, the bones from those animals are being used as, quote, the poor man's tiger in this traditional medicine. And as you, had this not been a sting operation, the man who paid $2,400 to the undercover officers, thinking they were poachers, those parts would have been immediately transported to Asia. There's an arrogance with poachers that really gets to me. There's this unethical aspect of it that is just beyond the pale. They are also, in my mind, unconcerned with any legal penalties, and this is our opportunity to change that. This is our opportunity to fine them significantly, to charge them with felonies where appropriate, and to make them think twice before they go out into our forests, over our waters, with the intent to poach our wildlife. It's time, essentially, to say that enough is enough. Another thing, as an attorney and as someone who understands that we have not only the legislative and the executive, but also the judicial branch, this, I believe, also sends a strong message to the judicial branch that we take this matter seriously and that these fines are being increased, these criminal penalties are being increased for a reason, and I think it's going to send a message that the judiciary needs to enforce these as well. You will hear today from a very diverse group. It's a coalition of hunting organizations, outdoor organizations, environmental organizations, representing vast interests throughout our natural resources community. I think the diversity and the strength of that coalition says volumes with regard to why this committee should pass this this legislation. Ask you all, obviously, for your support. Thank you also for your leadership. And that will conclude my relatively brief comments. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. And as noted, there have been some recommended amendments to this bill. It is my intention to keep the record open so that we can find those amendments that give the greatest amount of comfort and satisfaction of the greatest number of people. I would like to ask that the two of you help spearhead that effort and make sure that we get to that comfort zone. There are going to be some witnesses, I think, there will be, from the hunting and fishing communities who have also expressed a desire for some minor tweaking on some of the penalties, some of them possibly to be reduced and some of them to possibly be increased. It's a notion of, I think, parity that they have brought forward, and I think merits some attention. If I can have your assurance that you'll work with them to achieve that, to make a good bill better, I would appreciate that.
Again, Representative Helm, thank you, Chair Witt. We'll be happy to do that. And then if I could ask a favor of you in terms of the order in which we invite our witnesses up today, if we could have Captain Samuels be our first to testify so that he can return to his duties, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for that suggestion. Before the two of you run, questions or comments from our committee? Representative Whitsitt, please.
I think your idea is very good, and I support the general concept. I was wondering how we determine the intent of a hunter, mm-hmm. and I think that has a lot to do with how we would proceed forward with this. I mean, as a fisherman, I think it's difficult sometimes for beginning or seldom fishermen or hunters, like myself, for example, to know all the ODF and W rules. I mean, they're pretty complicated already, and so I think it goes to intent. Your bill goes to intent. Is that correct? What would happen to a first-time or seldom hunter or fisherman that took something unknowingly, you know, I mean, I've never done it, but I've heard of it happening, and, you know, how do you handle that situation?
Excellent question, Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt. It's my understanding that in 2011, some additional language was included in this statute that addresses culpable mental state and worked through all of those questions, particularly the question of what happens to a person, especially a youth, who might accidentally shoot an animal out of season or misidentify an animal, keep a fish that they're unsure of the species of. Those are understandable mistakes. And I think Captain Samuels can actually answer this question perhaps better than I. The important information for the committee, though, is in this bill, we don't touch that prior language at all. It was our view that those issues had been adequately addressed in by previous committees and previous legislative sessions, and that the idea of a culpable mental state and attaching a higher penalty when the infraction was knowing was appropriate. So we didn't try to rethink that. It's my opinion that that area is pretty well settled, and I think is working well, and that can be verified by Captain Samuels.
Okay, can I just follow up?
Please.
One of the things that I like to do in my off time is we have a small farm, and I go hiking, and I pick up feathers. I mean, just because they're on our property, it's private property, they're beautiful. I have no clue what they come from, but I have a whole you know, for anybody out there who wants to arrest me, I have a whole bunch of feathers that I've picked up. And in Section 2, it says the fact that any person has wildlife or any part thereof in possession when it is illegal to take or have same as prima facie evidence that such person killed such wildlife illegally. And then you go back up to bald eagle, golden eagle, goshawk, osprey, peregrine falcon, or any other raptor listed as a threatened or endangered species. I have no clue what I've picked up, but I'm walking along and I do that. So would I be in violation then and assumed to have killed the birds if I am out picking up feathers? And a lot of people do that.
Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt, two things I'd say about that. One, I think we need to look into that a little bit more. I'm not an expert on how the OSP enforces this. I would note that the Section 1 penalties come under the auspices of a suit by the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So they already have the delegated authority to determine when an infraction of some sort rises to the level of the seriousness represented by those penalties. But again, I think the culpable mental state provisions would also handle your case. I'm very open to unraveling that knot if we think that there's a problem for those collectors like yourself that have no intent of violating the law and just like to have these. I know that this also might apply to folks that are hiking and maybe find an antler or two that have been dropped and would like to have that as a decoration in their
you
house.
You can tell if it's been dropped, though.
It's on the ground.
See?
Thanks.
Ask the sportsman.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. These may be questions for the officer, I'm not quite sure, but I'd just like to broach the subject and get your read on it, and then it may be a more technical question that could be answered by someone else. There's a definition of poaching, and I think how we not cross that line from poaching to we have a home down at Agnes. We know a lot of folks who live in very rural areas who at times have issues with predators who come calling. We've had a black bear on our back porch with my 80-year-old mother standing in her nightgown fighting over the onion sack. We have had situations where cougar will end times encroach. And domestic animals can be at risk. Small children can be at risk at times. Those interfaces occur at times. And I think how we clearly define the difference between true poaching for financial gain and being in a situation where you have an animal that's crossing that boundary into a domestic setting and creating a position of risk for an individual or an animal is something that I'd like to see how you craft that in this legislation so we don't blur that line. If somebody's coming, if I have a cougar coming in my yard at Agnes and one of my nieces and nephews is there and it's menacing, I'm probably going to shoot it. And so how do you work through that? The second question, it may not be relevant, but I've been in a situation actually once, I don't know, almost twice, where we're out hunting out of Imnaha down in Lightning Creek and we're miles from anyone and we're hiking out. We see two guys hiking down two beautiful elk racks they're carrying, assuming they're going to go back and they've gutted this animal and they're going to go pack the meat out. They don't. We find the meat 2 days later, not gutted, total wanton waste of game. We actually had the license number of the truck, so we were able to turn it over to the state police, and they actually were able to go to court, and appropriate sanctions were imposed. But how does that scenario fit into what you're trying to do, or does it? It may not.
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen. Let me try to tackle the first question first, and I'm learning a little bit as we go about the distinction between an unlawful take of wildlife and a criminal unlawful take. So Captain Samuels will be better at describing this, but even an accidental taking of a mammal or a fish out of season, for example, or you keep it when you shouldn't, that's an unlawful take, but it may be without intent to do so. So there might be a ticket associated with that, but it doesn't trigger the mental intent, the culpable mental state that would escalate that to more serious penalties. And the state police, it's my understanding, are the front line of making that distinction between whether there's a criminal unlawful take, meaning an intention to poach, for example, and an innocent unlawful take. And that's already distinguished. And I think he would be better than I to actually help you understand how that happened on the ground.
It's sounding to me as though there has to be kind of an intent for financial gain or something of that nature that would kind of define these in two different ways. But I'll wait until the officer's here. Thank you.
I'm not sure how to answer the question about
the wanton waste.
The wanton waste. I think this would fall right in it.
Criminal to me, but it was an awful lot of meat that went to waste. If we'd known, we would have gone up and packed it out. Those events are very disturbing, and
Representative, in any regard, it's my understanding that this bill would not change much of that existing when you had to make a call between an illegal take versus a criminal activity. So we'll await until Captain Samuels is able to join us here. Additional questions or comments from the committee? I'm seeing none. Gentlemen, thank you for your willingness to assist the committee in arriving at a level of comfort with language that enables this bill to move forward. So thank you.
Thank all. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Captain Samuels. And, Captain, if there are others that you would like to have join you, please feel free. Welcome to our committee. You've heard a great number of the questions, so we're pleased that you're here.
So, excuse me, Chair Witt and committee members, good morning. My name is Jeff Samuels, for the record. I'm the captain, the division director for the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. And our division is tasked with enforcement of the fish and wildlife laws, as you know, in Oregon, also protecting the natural resources of the state. And we've been talking about, or I've been hearing about from the discussion earlier, you know, the relativity of poaching or unlawful take. And in Oregon, we do have a poaching problem, and we try to effectively address that. I think that approximately 2013, we track the illegal harvest that we detect. The number of animals that we detect are illegally harvested, whether there was a suspect or no suspect in that case. And in 2013, it was about 5,500 fish and wildlife that were unlawfully harvested. And that's only the portion that we know of. So there's obviously a lot more that goes on. There was some talk about this first part of House Bill 3537 or 2537 in Section 1. And I just wanted to clarify on that. So there is an offense for unlawfully taking a fish or wildlife species. And what happens is on the offense side, if it's committed with a culpable mental state, then fish and wildlife offenses are Class A misdemeanor. So if you knowingly or intentionally do something, it's a Class A misdemeanor. If you commit a fish and wildlife offense, the same offense without a culpable mental state, which was discussed earlier in the testimony, that could be a violation if it occurs in our presence. We could write it, and it would be similar to like a traffic citation with a presumptive fine. However, if you were convicted of that violation offense, this Section 1 and ORS 496705 could still apply. And so it's not just with intent relative to this restitution amount for the wildlife species listed. So I did want to clarify that. So I tried to address some of the questions that I heard. So if I missed one of those questions, I'd be happy to answer The question again, if someone could refresh my memory, if I missed one.
Thank you very much, for Captain, for making yourself available.
May I repeat my question?
Yes, please.
Chair Witt, if you don't mind.
Please.
I think the two scenarios that I brought up, I'm not sure where they fit into this conversation. One of them was an event that I witnessed where two gentlemen packed out two 6-point bulls, and we found the carcasses later. That's wanton waste. They had tags. They used their tags. They just wasted all the meat, which, you know, in my mind is a criminal. But the second scenario is that situation, and I know we have some testimony that came through here, where if you truly are in a rural area and you do have a predator that's menacing and you do find yourself at risk and you do dispatch that, how does that fit into this which it's not poaching, it's different, but I know there are some people who are concerned about how it's defined, so I'm just asking you to more clearly define that nexus when you find yourself in a pickle.
Sure. So, Chair Witt and Representative McEwen, to answer that question, so the bear situation that you discussed, there are some stipulations, but there are some alleviations in the wildlife statutes for human safety, those types of things, where the take of the bear isn't unlawful if it meets that criteria, so in the situation that you describe. My background comes from our Special Investigations Unit, and in that unit, we would do long-term cases, complex cases, and primarily focus on commercialization of wildlife. Okay, so, you know, as you know, in Oregon, we do have white sturgeon in the Columbia River. It's the largest population in North America. And we do have people that are interested in harvesting oversized sturgeon, like over 6 feet in length, overall length, and for the roe during the spring, usually, to make caviar and sell it on the black market or for their own use, as an example. The bear gallbladders, I had worked a case with others, you know, it's been several years ago, but we did infiltrate a group that was hound hunting unlawfully for bears, killing bears, removing the gallbladder, wasting the bear, and selling the gallbladders. And in that particular case, we actually went with racketeering as the offense because the wildlife statutes are a predicate offense to racketeering, and were successful in that case on the main suspect for racketeering as a felony, and that person received 18 months in prison. So there are all kinds of levels of what someone might call poaching or unlawful taking. So you might have the event like I just described, that this group targeting bears. You might have we recently had in the Sisters area, you might have heard, primarily it was a thrill kill, multiple deer being killed, all types of ways to kill the deer. You know, that wasn't commercialization, it was just unlawful killing of deer species. You have the cases that Representative Helm was talking about that are on our website right now, which one of which is we try to protect the mule deer on the winter range and other species on winter ranges. But we have people that actually target large mule deer bucks on the winter range, you know, and that's unlawful taking. But we also have people that might, you know, it's not lawful. We certainly take action and issue citations, but people would be with their family or with their friends in what we would call party hunting. So kill someone else's elk or deer, and then someone else loaning and borrowing of a tag to cover the unlawful take of the deer or elk type of situation. That's unlawful too. Does it rise to the level of the ring of the bear poacher for the gallbladder sale? It probably doesn't, but it still is unlawful, and it still is something that we would take care of. So does that get to answer your question?
I think it does. I just wanted on record, I think, because of some of the testimony that was supplied to us, that we clarify what the intent of this actually is. Mm-hmm. And I think you've done a good job of doing that, so okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Representative Esquivel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we just in Southern Oregon had a situation of where a couple of individuals shot and left lay two mature bull elk, and they cut the heads off and then left. and just left the whole body out there. That to me is that's beneath contempt, being a sportsman. But on the other hand, as for the black bear, we're having, believe it or not, a nationwide problem with this. I was in Alabama at the National Sportsman's Caucus, and they were having a heck of a time with people going out and shooting bears and just taking the gallbladder and then leaving the rest of the animal out there. In fact, the Louisiana black bear is becoming almost extinct due to that process. Mm. And the other things that we don't know about is that antlers are very much in demand in Asia as well. And the last thing is, though, is how do you determine this? My uncle was one of the best hunters I'd ever been around. He had taken 3 trophy mule deers that were over 36 on the inside. Now, those are once in a lifetime, but he got 3. Well, one time he shot at a buck, and there was a doe in front of the buck that had its head down feeding. And he went through the doe and killed the buck. But he didn't know he'd shot the doe until he got there. But the way the laws were, he was afraid to come forward. And that's unfortunate, because we need to have some sort of a situation. I mean, anybody could have figured it out. But how do you prove different? And that deer went to waste. And that's a shame, for fear of repercussions, even though how many of us could have made that mistake? And I'm not even sure it was a mistake, because what he saw was legal.
Well, and Representative, I don't want to leave Captain Samuels in the hot seat on this one. And
I'm asking, is there a way?
I suspect that if there are numerous cases like that, that it's up to us as a legislature to address that and make it possible. I think that in many instances, OSP does make the right call on those kinds of things and recognizes when mistakes have been made. I have actually witnessed someone who made a mistake, and OSP was called, and I could not have imagined a fairer outcome from the justice that was administered there on the spot. And we're fortunate that we have troopers that are professionals in every respect and not only enforce the law but understand the fallibility of the human species as well. And we are well served by our state police force here. So you make a very good point, and if there's a need for a tweak in some of our laws, that undoubtedly is up to us. But I personally have had experience where our state police administers the law in an exceedingly fair manner, I believe. I'd like to call next on Representative Whitsitt, and Representative Barreto is on deck.
So I just want to clarify back to my questions regarding feathers primarily and fish. So intent is not a consideration when leveling the fine for possession of it, even if you have no idea what kind of feather you have. You're saying the criminal aspect is out, but the fine still stays $10,000 for possession of a feather that is from a species that's listed. Did I understand you correctly?
So, Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt. So, on the piece of unlawful possession, so whether it be, you know, raptor parts, or someone finds a road-struck buck deer and, you know, think it's dead already and thinks that it'd be nice to have, it's a really nice rack, it's got a 36-inch spread or something, that they cut it off thinking that they didn't do anything wrong. Well, it is unlawful to possess fish and wildlife species in Oregon unless you can lawfully, based on, you know, tags or seasons and those types of things. So each case is different. But on feathers, so if a person, like a situation you mentioned on bird feathers, whether it be raptor parts or there was a dead raptor and you wanted to have the talons or whatever it might be. If you're unaware of the law, that's that piece about the culpable mental state that gets into a violation type treatment. But I think what you would have to do is I'd have to further look into this relative to the piece you just asked me about on the restitution amount for that, because it talks about section 2 talks about the fact that any person has in possession parts have been removed from the carcasses of two or more game mammals, game birds, or fish when it is unlawful to remove those. It's pretty specific in that regard. So
two feathers.
Well, I would think that one bird has more than one feather.
Okay, so you know, but it's not an individual feather, then. You're saying it's more...
It's talking more about two game mammals, game birds, or fish.
Or parts.
Or parts thereof.
Okay, well...
That's, but not two parts. It's parts of two or more is what I believe it's saying in there.
Right.
Well, I would have to do further review get right to your question.
I am still having a little
feather
bit of an issue because sometimes, you know, I don't find dead birds. I find a feather, and I have no idea. But you go on a long hike, and sometimes you have two feathers or whatever. So it's you know, $10,000 would be a lot to go pick up a feather.
And Representative, this may be an item that the group that's looking at amendments may want to address with your assistance.
Thanks.
Let's see. I'm trying to remember who I had next. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Going back to maybe what the first testimonies were, saying poaching is epidemic, and that kind of draws on emotion, you know, that our wildlife is getting... you know, erased. But I'm a hunter too, and I'm a fisherman, and I love to do that, and I love to see the wildlife protected. But when we stopped hunting cougars and bears with dogs, the population went way up, and the cougar tags and the bear tags went down. You mentioned that there was a case this last year, I think, on the harvesting of bears for gallbladders, and they were probably harvesting the bears with dogs. Is that a, you know, common? I mean, how many of those cases do you come across every year here in Oregon? You know, maybe in Louisiana, like Representative Escobar mentioned, they can still hunt with dogs, and they do that on a regular basis. But how many in Oregon do we see every year?
So thank you for that question. So Chair Witt and Representative Barreto, the case that I mentioned to you was actually a long time ago.
Oh.
Quite a long time ago. And on the bear gallbladder case. And we really don't see all that many of those types of cases. Usually on that case, it was a ring of people, you know, more than three, that were in an enterprise doing that unlawful operation. So it definitely occurs, and we've had some more recent cases more on the lines of poaching of sturgeon, unlawful take of oversized sturgeon for the roe to make into caviar, and have had those cases as well. So it does happen, and is it happening today? It could be happening today. Is it to the level that I was describing? I'm not sure, but it certainly is something that we are looking into. And again, you know, what I've tried to reference is that poaching is a problem in Oregon. And that's why I've said that, you know, even of the species that we've identified in 2013 as, you know, 5,500 unlawfully taken wildlife, I mean, that's an amount that we just detected ourselves. So there's a lot more that we never even came upon.
Sure.
Or didn't know about, that the public didn't tell us about.
Thank you very much. I have next Representative McEwen, Representative Frederick on deck. It looks like we have a number of other questions. Committee members, we have 25 minutes left and a room full of witnesses yet to testify, and I literally mean a room full of witnesses. To the extent that we can be very concise with our questions at this point in time, we need to be. So please help me with that.
Farmer exempt.
Shed
Shedhorn.
Yeah, Representative Witt and Rep. McEwen.
That's all.
Thank you very much, Representative Frederick.
Thank you. I will be very brief. We should talk later on. I am concerned about the history of the whole bear gallbladder and the poaching. For me, goes back to the late 70s, doing stories on that kind of poaching, and so we've had this thing going on for quite a while. It's a concern. And the other thing is, my wife is an artist who also goes hiking and finds feathers, and she has no idea what those feathers are. But she then puts them into artistic pieces, and she has been known to sell a few artistic pieces. She would have no idea, looking at the feather, whether this was something that might be a problem. It's something that I'd like to, if you can get back to me on that, that'd be great.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
Thank you. I just might, from my understanding of your testimony, you would find this particular bill helpful in your ability to do your work.
So, Representative Witt and Vice Chair McLean, I'm going to say that I'm neutral on this bill, and I'd be happy to help make this bill the best that it can be.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments? Captain Samuels, thank you so very, very much, sir. Appreciate your technical assistance here this morning and your patience with all of our questions. Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Al Elkins and Stan Steele and Rich Thompson. While they're coming up, I would just like to ask that from this point forward, if all of the witnesses could please limit your testimony to 3 minutes so that we get the essence out of your testimony. That will provide for a couple of minutes of questions from committee members, and hopefully we can get through all of the witnesses and out of here on time. Thank you very much for your appearance here today. Welcome to our committee.
Thank
Please
you.
Decide among yourselves the order in which you'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. We applaud you and everyone that's brought this bill forward. Thank you for doing that. Over the years, OHA has been a part of work groups that have put similar bills together to raise fines and penalties. We have worked with all the fishing groups, from steelheaders to native fish to Oregon anglers. We have also had in the room at the same time Audubon Society of Portland, Humane Society of the United States, and other groups as well. We've all brought forward legislation. Two of the pieces that were mentioned earlier remove the sunset that allows the laws that we help develop continue. My point in being here today, and the point I want to make, is that what I have learned from this process is that the underlying discussions that we have all had and continue to have is that these cases, although some are being prosecuted in the state of Oregon, many are not. And that no matter how high you levy the fines, no matter how stiff the penalties are that you make, we do not believe that we're getting the support from prosecutors and the judges in the courts. And that's what I hear from all of the groups when we work on this topic. And I'm sure others will share that with you today. The second observation I'd like to make to you today is, and I'm going to have to read this, is that with you today is the section of the bill on page 3 of the bill, and it starts on line 29, section 11 of the bill, and it says this language: the court shall impose a fine that is. The last time I worked on this type of legislation, we changed the word may to shall. And after the law, after this, the bill became law, I received 3 phone calls, 2 from prosecutors and 1 from a judge, who, after they said, "What is wrong with you?" they said, "What this may to shall does is it ties the hands of the court. That's what the judge said to me, and the prosecutor said basically the same thing. Both prosecutors said it ties their hands in relation to what they can go after in terms of a sentence for the person that they're going after. So having those two experiences, those three phone calls, has made us very cautious, OHA very cautious, about changing any language that would restrict the court or tie their hands. So my point to you today is this. It's about time we had a sit-down roundtable discussion with all parties involved. We can all talk to each other. All the people in this room can talk to each other. We're very passionate about this subject. Poaching is a nasty, nasty thing. But until we get the prosecutors and judges at the table to talk to us and hear our passion and maybe explain to us what language we could present to them in bill form that would help them and would also satisfy our needs, I don't think we can write all the fines we want. But until we have that discussion, I don't think we're going to get much further than we are today. And that's where we are on this bill. We support it 100%. We just need help in getting it implemented. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Elkins. And maybe you and I and some others need to meet with the chair of the Judiciary Committee.
Yes.
And have further discussions as you suggest.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We have to talk with Representative Krieger in the past about this. He is as passionate about the subject as we are. That would be a great place to start. I'd also recommend maybe those that represent in the building, judges and prosecutors, join us. I don't know how far we'll get, but it needs to happen.
Be happy to make myself available for that purpose.
Thank you. Thank you.
Gentlemen, who's next?
Chair Witt, good morning. Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rich Thompson, Traditional Archers of Oregon. Ditto to everything that's been said here this morning. thank you very much for recognizing that poaching is a problem and taking actions to do things about it. I'll just get right to my point.
We
talked a lot about recommended amendments and so forth this morning, and one that crossed my mind after serving on the archery review public archery advisory committee last year with ODFW. One thing that crossed our minds as a group working on this project was that perhaps there should be some premium units as well as trophy animals. I'm looking at 16 points into trying to get a Metolius deer tag so I can go try and shoot a deer with a bow.
Okay.
And if the Metolius, for an example, that particular hunt, 139R1.
Mr. Thompson, we're really pressed for time, and
okay.
That's going to be another bill, I think. So.
Okay, what I'm recommending you see, if it isn't already on the list, is that you recognize premium units and go as far as to up the ante on fines in those premium units.
I suspect that may be another bill this session.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee, my name is Stan Steele, Corvallis, Oregon, representing the Oregon Hunters or Oregon Outdoor Council. Actually, we blend. I spent my 25-year professional career as a fish and wildlife enforcement for the Oregon State Police, enforcement officer out of Corvallis. Worked the same case that Captain Samuels was referring to on the illegal harvest, illegal take of bear galls. Poaching is not an Oregon problem. It's a nation problem. It's a worldwide problem. Mm-hmm. Don't emotionalize something to make it appear more or less important than it really is. We have a problem. But why we can't address it is from case citation level to court disposition, it's very difficult to track. So when we impose or want to raise a high ceiling on civil damage restitutions, oftentimes we're not even getting those. We can't track. There's a whole system breakdown, which really means that our system, from the time we're out there trying to detect and deter, is failing, clear too, when we're actually taking those through the judicial process. So Al and everyone else is absolutely correct. We need to review this whole system. This bill is a fantastic concept. Let's make it a fantastic bill. And I think that, the best process to do that is to actually include judicial, because, frankly, we have counties in this state right now that are not prosecuting big game crimes. So there's a breakdown. There's a fundamental breakdown in the system. We can correct that. But I really do agree with everyone. It's going to take everyone working together, putting aside ideologies to protect our fish and wildlife and do what's best for them. And I think we can do that. So my request to the committee is give us some time, help us by appointing possibly a work group to where when we can come back here, we can come back with something that is very, very good, can be supported, and will serve Oregon well, more than just the next session, for decades down the road. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask that the three of you make yourselves available to work with the folks that are drafting amendments to try and get to that place. Are there any really critical questions or comments from the committee at this point? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. I appreciate your testimony and your willingness to assist in making this bill as good as we can get it. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Bob Olson, Tom Wolf, and Jim Myron. Gentlemen, again, please, if you can, 3 minutes maximum. We've still got a number of people here who are signed up. I'd also like to note, while you're on your way up, that Representative Gorsuch found it impossible to be able to get here today. He will have, please, for the record, an excused absence. Gentlemen, decide among yourselves the order that you will proceed, and please go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Bob Olson, Association of Northwest Steelheaders. We really appreciate you having this hearing today. The Association of Northwest Steelheaders strongly supports the concepts in House Bill 2537. It's a bill, as you know, providing tougher and more appropriate penalties. We also have contempt for the hardcore poachers who steal away our precious natural resources. Our state needs to keep seeking more effective ways to pursue and punish these criminals. Fine-tuning and enacting such bills as House Bill 2537 will send a powerful message to the entire justice system and to the public. Plus, it improves the numbers, status, and management of our valuable fish and wildlife. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. I will be brief. We also support the concept in this bill. We hope that you will approve appropriate amendments to it to make it a better bill and move it on its way. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I will be very brief also. Trout Unlimited supports this bill. Also, we are particularly interested in the sections on sturgeon, particularly the section that would make a removal of the roe part of the bill. We think that this is a major problem. There are people that are actually targeting oversized sturgeon to harvest their eggs as caviar, as Captain Samuels mentioned. So we support this bill. We are happy to work on any amendments that are needed to make this bill pass, and we think this is a great concept, and we support it 100%. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Gentlemen, appreciate your appearance today. Thank you for being here. Questions or comments for the fishing community? I'm not seeing or hearing any. Tom, you mentioned a poaching of a sturgeon. I went on a ride-along with the OSP on a poaching enforcement for sturgeon, and some folks, most fishers, are just wonderful people. Those who engage in poaching, period, fishing or otherwise, they're a rough bunch. And OSP who goes out in the wilds of our state alone to enforce it, we need to appreciate the tough job that those folks do each and every day. Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Brian Posovitz, Scott Beckstead, and Bob Salinger, please. Good morning, gentlemen, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director and Western Regional Director for the Humane Society of the United States, here in strong support of House Bill 2537. The Humane Society of the United States considers poaching to be a major animal welfare issue. We have a reward program that has paid thousands and thousands of dollars here in Oregon for poaching rewards, where we work along with the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Hunters Association, to offer substantial rewards for information on poaching cases, and we're pleased and very proud that that program has brought a number of poachers to justice. We certainly support strengthening the bill to add additional components to it to make it even stronger. Just an idea that I just had when we were talking about the judicial piece. You know, here in Oregon, we have a special prosecutor who runs the circuit statewide to assist district attorneys in the prosecution of animal cruelty cases. Perhaps we could consider a special prosecutor to deal just with these wildlife cases. It could serve an educational mission as well as taking the load off of some of these local DAs that are already overstretched. The other thing I want to put on the record, I want to address something, Representative Barreto, that you said regarding cougars. I just want it for the record. There were 560 cougar tags issued the year before Measure 18 was passed in 1993. In 2012, according to ODFW, there were 50,889 cougar tags issued. Cougar hunters are now killing between 2 and 3 times more cougars without the use of dogs than before. And I also want to put for the record that ODFW's mortality data for cougars does not include cougars that are poached or cougars that are killed legally but not reported. So I just wanted to put that on the record, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to take questions of the entire panel all at once, just to expedite this. I'm sorry, I apologize to each of you for the pressure, but I've got 5 minutes left.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Brian Posowitz. I am here today on behalf of a new organization called Humane Oregon. Humane Oregon was formed last year to help advocate for humane treatment of animals in the political process and in elections. I just am here to make the general statement that we are in support of the concept of this bill without getting into the particulars of the language and the proposed amendments. And just I want to make the general statement that humane treatment of animals means different things to different people, but I think most people would agree that it includes at least respecting the laws that are designed to preserve Oregon's fish and wildlife, and that this bill would help encourage respect for those laws. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for Portland Audubon Society.
Welcome.
We are also very much in support of this bill. We think it's very important. We were actually founded in 1902 in part to pass some of the first bird protection laws in Oregon. And it remains a real big problem today. We run the largest wildlife hospital in Oregon. We take in about 3,000 animals a year, and we see a tremendous number of poaching cases. And they come to us from the public, they come to us from the state or DFW, state police, and they bring them to us, and we try and fix these animals and get them back to the wild. That can cost thousands of dollars. I've included a number of pictures of animals that we've treated over the last couple of years. We're particularly concerned about birds of prey. We see a lot of birds of prey shot. And these are really egregious and in many cases, very sadistic crimes. We've seen osprey shot off of nests left on the ground to die with their young starving overhead. There's a picture of a bald eagle we treated recently that's got a constellation of a shotgun blast pellets in its system. Several years back, we had a situation where we worked with the state to release peregrine falcons back to the wild. And an organized group of people, in this case pigeon clubs, shot those birds out of the sky. Let me read you a quick quote just to give you a sense of how sadistic that was. I laughed when I heard this story because of all the hard work that went into the measures to bring these birds to adolescence and release them to the wild. To have one of our fellows take them out was pure bliss. Remember, fellas, use the 3S system, shovel, and shut up. Those were birds that hundreds of volunteers worked on, thousands of dollars went into, and they were deliberately killed. And so one point I want to make today is we ask a tremendous amount of the public in terms of volunteer time, restoring habitat, recovering species, working in wildlife rehabilitation centers. We need to honor that work that we put in, that commitment, that investment, and we need to do it with more than fines that are simply the equivalent of a traffic ticket. We also have a reward system that we put out for information on poaching. And I'll tell you, we hesitate to do it because we know that we're going to pay more in the reward than the poachers are going to pay when they get caught. I would emphasize the comments that have already been made that we need to work with the judicial system. Again, no matter how much we put into these fines, if they're not enforced, it won't matter. Last thing I wanted to say was I think it's very important to note that Section 3 is language that's already been in effect for several years. It was passed in 2011. Unfortunately, it had a sunset on it. We didn't catch it in time, so it sunsetted. So Section 3, for the most part, is already existing language that went out of effect in January 1st, and we need to bring that back. So just know that's already been in effect. So thank you very much. Really urge you to move this bill forward.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Are there questions or comments from the committee members?
Just have one to Scott.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Thank you for those numbers. I mean, that's what I was trying to get is the emotional, you know, or the straw man out of it and just get numbers that you can base decisions on.
Thank you so very, very much. Appreciate your making yourselves available, and I would ask that also, if any of you feel strongly about amendments, if you'd please express your concerns with the folks who have already volunteered, I'd appreciate it very, very much. Thank you. And I think last but not least, Quinn Reed, and if there is anyone else in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 2537, to please come up. Quinn, welcome to our committee, and sorry for the pressure, but you have 2 minutes.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Quinn Reed, and I represent Oregon Wild. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this morning and to offer our enthusiastic support for this bill. I want to start off by saying that Scott Beckstead's question about a special prosecutor is one that Oregon Wild would be very interested in pursuing further. I also want to emphasize that this bill, built on an existing body of law, is important because it focuses on the growing demand from the international illegal trade in wildlife parts. And it does that by focusing on the parts in highest demand and spurring activities on the supply side of that last activity. Oregon Wild is specifically interested in this bill for a few reasons. One, we believe that in this time when the agency charged the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is facing a budget shortfall, poaching shows flagrant disregard for that agency and the laws that the agency seeks to implement and enforce. It also takes already limited resources away from the people who are playing by the rules. Oregon Wild is also interested in making sure that there are tools in place to make sure that poaching of threatened and endangered species is adequately deterred. Finally, in terms of amendments, we are very interested in looking at poaching of collared research animals. And we've seen evidence that sometimes collared animals can be a particular target to poachers. Collared animals represent a huge amount of resources invested by the public, by ODF&W and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to collar, track, and collect data. So illegal takes of those animals, it's not just the animal, it's also valuable scientific information and public resources represented there. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for your excellent testimony. Questions or comments from Ms. Reed? Oh. Mm-hmm. Seeing none, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Again, I would ask that anyone who is envisioning amendments to this bill, please meet with Representative Helm and Mr. Krakke. And again, if the two of you'd raise your hands, If you might stay for a couple of minutes after we adjourn so that folks can come up to you and let you know that they're interested in participating in that venture, I'd appreciate it. With
Chair,
that, yes,
one,
Representative Esquivel.
Just for the record, in this bill, in Section 1, C, I think that the for each elk, as it knows described in subparagraph K of this paragraph, $1,500 fine, I think that should be at least $5,000, and I'll tell you why. When you shoot a cow and leave it to lay, you've taken maybe 10 animals out of the whole picture. That, to me, is just as imperative as a mature bull. And the other one, of course, is a 6x6, which I agree with.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2537. Chuck, what do we have real quickly next time?
Tuesday, 8 a.m., we have a public hearing on HB 2534, directs State Fish and Wildlife Commission to adopt rules prohibiting use of drones for angling or hunting. HB 2536 requires applicants for license tags, permits to angle, take, hunt, trap, or attest the applicant's consents to inspection. And HB 2051, which reduces the penalty for the crime of criminal trespass in the second degree in certain circumstances.
Thank you very much. My thanks and appreciation to all of the witnesses today for helping us get to where we're at. There's a lot of work ahead of us. Yeah. My thanks to the committee for helping us almost adjourn on time. Almost adjourn on time. Almost.